An Academic Odyssey is your guide to understanding and demystifying the path to a doctorate in the humanities. Join me, first-generation student Olivia Ojeda, on my journey through the intricate process of applying for a PhD in the humanities as my mentor, Chuck Robinson, and I interview scholars from various disciplines to uncover the challenges and opportunities and explore the nuances of advanced graduate study. Welcome to another episode of An Academic Odyssey. Today, we are joined by Scott Yarbrough. Scott earned his BA and MA in English at Florida State, emphasis on writing, and a PhD in American literature at Alabama, where he focused on the novel, American literature, modernism, and Southern literature. He has taught in the English department at Charleston Southern University since 1997 and served as chair from 2003 to 2017. He is currently the Associate Vice President of Academic Affairs for Compliance, Retention, and Graduate Studies. He is the co-author of A Practical Introduction to Literary Study and co-editor to the two volumes of The Road in the Cormac McCarthy Casebook series, Carrying the Fire. He has published articles and chapters on McCarthy, Hemingway, Faulkner, and Billy Collins, among others, and has published fiction in a variety of venues. He was a 2008 South Carolina Arts Commission Prose Fellow and was the president of South Atlantic Modern Language Association in 2017. He and his wife, Lee, live in Mount Pleasant with their two daughters, Marie and Eleanor, and their two bad dogs.
So, Olivia, how did you come to know Scott?
So, I came to know of Scott through his own podcast, which is titled Reading McCarthy. And it's probably one of the, if not the only McCarthy podcast that's out there. And it's full of other scholars, especially McCarthy scholars that I love to listen to. So, I became a big fan of his work. And also came to know of a lot of other scholarship through his own podcast. I came to know him and speak with him and chat with him through Twitter. I actually sent him a direct message through Twitter and asked him if he would like to read one of my papers on McCarthy and Blood Meridian. And he said yes. So I sent him my essay and he read it and we just have got to talking ever since. So Scott, welcome to the podcast. Why don't you start off by telling us what your title is?
My title as of 2 weeks ago has just become the Vice President of Student Success at Charleston Southern University. For a very long time, I was Associate Vice President of Academic Affairs, so the Associate Chief Academic Officer. And my field is English, particularly American literature, and particularly 20th century and 21st century American literature. But I've kind of crawled the ladder into administration simply as a way of paying the bills a little better.
Have you heard of the term invisible syllabus? If so, what does that term mean to you? And how does elitism affect the processes of postgraduate education and academic employment?
I think I'm probably going to need you to define it because although I have heard of it, my memory is cloudy on how it was defined. And I think I read it in a way that given any particular university or department, they have expectations of what you should be interested in or teaching. And if you are varying in a different direction, then they may not look favorably upon you. There's a lack of kind of engagement with academic freedom and choice sometimes, and more a presumption you need to cover A, B, C, D. But is that actually correct, or what it's really meant by that term?
Yeah, it can be. So I had another interviewee, he called it the hidden curriculum. And so everybody has these different terms for it. And it's basically just everything in academia that you are expected to know that unless you have a background in academia, you really don't know about these things. Right. For instance, conferences, I didn't know why, like what conferences were, what was the big deal about them. But Chuck told me you really should start going to conferences and reading your papers so that you engage more with other people. People know who you are and et cetera, et cetera. So, and then you also have it on your CV. So, and I didn't know that.
For years at the, I used to be pretty involved with the South Atlantic Modern Language Association and was an officer on their board and even president for 1 year. And it's rotation, so you only do a year of it. And one of the panels I specialized in with a couple of other people was just learning the profession panels, where we'd do panels on how to give a presentation. And it can't be your seminar paper, it's 30 pages. You have to trim that thing down to 15 minutes, come hell or come high water. It can't go on and on and on, which is what I sometimes refer to as grad student disease at a conference, when you hear 30 minutes and two-thirds of it is laying out the theoretical framework before we get to a thesis. That's something to avoid. But it is, there is a lot of unspoken things to the profession that took me by surprise. You described yourself to me before we started recording as first generation. I wasn't, but my dad had been in the service for a number of years and was definitely non-traditional. And he went to school by day and painted houses by night. My mom worked for the state, and I was, you know, shipped off to childcare. My brother was born while he was still a student. So my dad did not have a real traditional college experience either. And I only really understood how things worked in graduate school because I had an older friend who was getting his master's degree, and he was mentioning it to me, and I wanted to get one. I said, I don't know how I can afford that. I'll have to go work for a few years. He said, well, you get an assistantship and they'll pay for it for you. You just have to teach and you don't get a lot to live on. But, and I had never heard of a teaching assistantship. I'd heard of TAs and didn't realize what that meant and how it worked. And then once I became a TA for my master's level, I started finding out how the whole process worked for going on into PhD programs and working as an assistant all through those things, one way or the other. And so we, again, the profession, even what an assistant professor is versus associate professor versus tenure and how those things work, a lot of times are very mysterious to people wanting to enter the profession. And as a whole, we could do much better than we do.
Yeah, it's interesting. Almost everybody that we've interviewed, including yourself now, a lot of them have said, I wouldn't have known blank without this person that came in and kind of mentored me. So it seems like mentorship is kind of the key when it comes to accessing academia.
I think so. I think when you're going into a traditional program, which has a large body of graduate students, they do a reasonably good job of trying to train you and hook you up with mentors and people in two different ways. For instance, when I entered a PhD program, I had a younger TA assigned to me as my kind of buddy that I was supposed to help and teach how to teach some and give examples of syllabi and how to deal with classroom situations, which was a little weird given that on paper, I'd only had 4 years of teaching experience myself, and two of those were as an adjunct between my master's and my PhD. But it did work, and then we had a weekly class on how to be a grad student, how to teach at the graduate, or how to teach freshmen and sophomore, you know, core classes as graduate students as well. And that's one of the ways that they get around a kind of accreditation rules, and you have to have a certain number of hours to start teaching. You have to have a certain amount of training to do these things, and that's one of the ways to big state schools who completely depend on graduate students to make ends meet when it comes to teaching all the freshmen and sophomore, you know, core classes. That's one of the ways they kind of are able to keep the wheels turning, if you will, and keep the flags waving, is through using grad students. And in some cases, graduate students have, you know, protested, this is really not fair. And of course it's not. It's just very often the professors, since they all had to deal with it, they just kind of shrug and don't pay a lot of attention to it.
What difference does a background in academia or sense of access to academia make to prospective PhD students?
I think in terms of if they've had a lot of family knowledge or gone to schools that are expecting a lot of people to go on into higher level programs, especially now that a number of PhD programs are skipping people right past a master's and into a PhD, then having had that kind of access is helpful because you just know a lot of people who can tell you, here are the things I focused on in my letters. Here's what I did with my writing samples. Here are the recommendations I used and the ones I didn't use because so-and-so at this school doesn't like this professor or something. And you would think it wouldn't be that petty, but anyone who's worked for very long in higher education knows that sometimes it is that petty. Not often and not always, but enough to make us disappointed, I'd say.
Tell us the story of how you decided and figured out how to enroll in a PhD program.
When I started my master's degree, I was going to be a famous writer who was a kind of combination of respected as William Faulkner, but popular as Stephen King. And about 3 months or 5 months in, this is at Florida State, and they were then and now a pretty good writing program, pretty well known. My main professor, one of my main professors, Jerry Stern, had a weekly show on NPR. Janet Burway was one of the other ones, and her book is still the primary book used in a lot of creative writing departments for, you know, writing fiction. And I enjoyed it a lot, but as I spent time there, I first realized how much what I was doing writing in a master's creative writing program wasn't really going to get me published or get me employed. And I also realized how much I loved my teachers' lifestyles, meaning they were teaching 2 to 3 classes, taking a lot of time off, spending most of their time with juniors and seniors and graduate students. They were making good living. I wasn't scared at the time of parish or publish or anything like that. And partly because I didn't know a whole lot about it. And somewhere along this process, I started thinking, I can do the creative writing if I want to, but I'm probably not going to really ever make a living at it anytime soon. I need a plan A and let the creative writing be my plan B that hopefully one day it'll change. And I started thinking, what are other things I could do? So I started talking to a couple of professors, and a lot of them said, you should really think about, you know, getting your PhD. Now, there are a few who pushed me to think about getting it in creative writing, and I knew immediately that was not really the best way to go. Which is not to say you can't get a lot of value out of a PhD in creative writing, but it's hard to find people who are looking to employ you with a PhD in creative writing. And your ability, your attractiveness to a creative writing program is entirely based on what you've published. And if you have an MFA or a PhD, for most places, most schools, they don't really see that much of a difference. Community colleges, small colleges might be more attracted to the PhD in creative writing, but otherwise. So I had started this great reading project, and I took 2 years off after my master's to work for the state of Florida to earn money to live on, because I found I couldn't do things like buy a car or pay my insurance, you know, based on what I was making as a teaching assistant. And during that time, I went on this audacious project to read every important novel I should have read and hadn't. And I didn't get through all of them, but I got through a whole lot of them. And to just get myself ready. And I also went around and talked to all my professors about schools I should apply to and ones I shouldn't apply to. And I was given very good and very bad advice. The good advice was, don't go there if they're not going to pay you to go there, unless it's the kind of place where everyone gets a job. These days, the assistantships and fellowships are much harder to come by than they were back then. So I would say that's not necessarily still a good rule, but it was in the 90s when I went to grad school. And the other thing was, you know, make sure you focus on major writers and not on people, things people haven't heard of, things people are not interested in. And then I was told by some people, this is a good school, this is not a good school, I like this school. And there are a couple of schools I did kind of turn my nose up, and I found out later for what I was interested in, which is modernist American literature, some of the schools I didn't even apply to were way better than the ones I did apply to. Then a couple of the ones I applied to that I was interested in didn't give me an assistantship right off. And their process was simple. You had to wait until a certain date, then they decide who got what kind of assistantship or fellowship, which at the time I thought was really stingy, and later I found out it was very common. And then where I went, Alabama very quickly said, and part of it was some of the professors who were on the committee at Alabama knew some of my professors at Florida State, so the recommendation carried more weight. And they very quickly said, yes, you can have this assistantship. In fact, we'll give you a special one. And you'll also, but you need to affirm it by this date, which contradicted the other dates. So I had a bird in the hand. I was still waiting to hear from LSU, still waiting to hear from another couple of schools. I'd heard from some places that were very prestigious. Yes, you get in, but we're not giving you a fellowship or assistantship your first year. And my attitude was, well, I can't afford you, even if it would make me look very attractive. So I didn't go there. So I ended up going to Alabama almost without knowing anything about anyone there. Or I knew one person there because she had also done her master's at Florida State and was kind of a homegrown child and kind of a star at the time. And everyone loved her. And she was a very good mentor for me as well. But and I went there and then I focused on William Faulkner.
You said something about, you were talking about the professor lifestyle. You liked that lifestyle. And it's, I just wanted to touch on this really quickly because Chuck actually stopped me as soon as I said, I'm interested in a PhD. Do you have any info for me? And he said, well, let me stop you right there, because if you're thinking about this grand lifestyle of the English professor living in this nice house and having friends over and, you know, blah,
blah,
blah.
Those Halcyon days.
Yeah. And I was like, that's exactly how I'm picturing it. And he was like, those days are gone. And he gave me a couple titles. One was, The Professor Is In, and he said, go buy that book, and I want you to get acquainted with the world of academia and your chances of becoming a professor and also your chances of ever being paid well. So anyways, I just wanted to kind of touch on that really quick, because everything you said, I thought too.
There's a real have and have not situation going on in academia. And it's just gotten worse in the humanities. Now, it really depends on your field. So if you're in chemistry or physics or any medical sciences these days, things are still pretty good in a lot of places. But what we see now is you've got your elites, you've got your other small private semi-elites, which very often don't have very large graduate programs, and you have the state universities, and then you have everyone else. And what I didn't realize was that there's always a kind of moving target of what's in your field. And it may well be that if you chose the right thing and had the right publications, then you really could land a job at a good state school. And some of that, what you're thinking about, would still be true. But you do have to understand that that is so much harder to land these days than ever was. And I was told this story as I was starting out the PhD program in the early 90s, that there was a whole generation of these baby boomer professors are going to be retiring and the schools were going to be in need of all these professors. And I found meeting people who were 10, 15, 20 years younger than me, they were all being told the same story for decades. And when I went on the job market in the second half of the 90s, I was told, oh, the job market's horrible right now. No one's retiring. Schools are cutting positions and just rehiring adjuncts or lecturers. And people who are out right now are being told the exact same thing. And it's amazing how long this is. So I think it went from bad to worse. And part of it is the ongoing marketplace and the complete lack of friendliness toward the humanities. So at smaller colleges, humanities numbers have dwindled horribly. And when I say humanities, I mean the classical humanities we think of are not classical, but you know what I mean. English, history, foreign languages, art history, and so on have dwindled horribly. I think state schools, depending where they are, and also depending on the demographic makeup of their students, maybe do a little better. What we're seeing is as men dwindle in terms of the numbers of them in college, they have a tendency to see college as simply a way to be stamped ready to be employed. Women students are much more approaching colleges in the way that traditionally people did. This is how you get an education. So I've found that women students are much more ready to take a chance on following their heart, following the, you know, a calling to learn more about literature or philosophy or history and, or art history than men. They're willing to run the risk that I may not step right into a ready-made job that an engineer or nurse or accountant would find. And by the same token, because of those dwindling numbers, it means that people, if they, as they go to the big schools, the smaller schools have less and less students to bring in. And so there's a constant threat to focus on the bottom line and to pay for all these extra things that a university is doing, the really fancy student centers, the, you know, top quality cafeterias, the much nicer dorm spaces and amazing workout arenas that simply just didn't exist in earlier generations in the way they do now. And so the money's going there. Now, after you get at a big university, the teaching load might still be only two classes or even three classes. And some of them are now splitting professors saying, okay, if you want off the publish or perish track, you can teach three or four classes a year. So if it's a traditional 3-hour credit hour class, you might say you have three in fall and four in spring to teach, but there's no expectation of significant publication. And then if you're research track, then it's two and three or three and two. And that's happened at a lot of schools, and especially in the Midwest and heading out west. But really the other tier we see is when you look at smaller schools that might have master's programs, but if they have doctorates, it's usually professional or clinical doctorates, like doctorate of physical therapy, of, you know, doctor D-Pharm degrees or something. And if they have master's degrees, they very often it's master's of arts and teaching or master's of education, which is what we have at Charleston Southern. So the professors of these schools there are expectations of publishing, but it's usually not an up or out tenure process. Instead, it ends up being a real push toward be a teacher first, a scholar second. And you often have a divide among faculty administrators, the ones who think that scholarship is important to make you good at teaching, where I would place myself in that category, and the ones who say it's just about the teaching. And again, you're teaching four classes of undergraduates, and it's maybe two freshman comp classes, a sophomore survey, and an upper level class. That's a big load, and it's really hard to get a lot of reading and writing on your own done outside of all that grading. The benefits of being at a small school, though, is you get to decide the hats you wear. So if you're divided between loving to do literary stuff, you want to do creative writing, you might well have the opportunity to write creatively or to teach creative writing classes. And they may not count a few short stories or poems as much as it would a refereed article, but it would still count. But the problem is you get used to spreading yourself thin instead of really doubling down and focusing in one area. And if your goal is to climb up to a better school, well, you've spread yourself pretty thin, and that other school just wants to see your best area.
I just want to jump in and talk about what Scott, the phrase Scott just used was short stories and poems may not count as much as refereed articles, but they still count. I want to put a footnote on that word count. And what I understand Scott to be saying there is he's referring to annual reviews or That's annual right. reports, where at the end of each year, when you get a position, just about any position, most adjuncts will be exempt from it, but any other academic teaching/research position, at the end of every academic year, you file a report, and they can get quite long, and you essentially list everything you've been doing in the year, what's happened in your teaching, what's happened in your research, and what's happened in your service. And if you're on the tenure track, those go in a sort of portfolio or a file, which will eventually get reviewed to see if you will be granted tenure, and then later it'll be reviewed to give you promotions from assistant to associate, and then maybe associate to full professor. Do I have that right, Scott?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You are always going to be evaluated in terms of how well you're doing. And at most schools, even if you're at one that's primarily a teaching institution, they do want to see some evidence of some scholarship. Now, the bar will be significantly lower than you would see at a place like Duke, right? Where you if you don't get a book out and one under contract, you're probably not going to get tenure in most cases, I would say. But on the other hand, at our little school, I used to always tell everyone, you kind of need to get an article or get a paper accepted to a conference and then do the work to turn that paper into an article you can send out. And that's usually the progress I would push my faculty when I was chair of the English department, which I was for well over a decade. And that was how I would try to groom them and mentor them to being successful in that part of their career. There would be other things challenging them in terms of teaching or in terms of service and all that as well. But that would be the main way to kind of keep your hand in. The great thing, of course, about getting a paper accepted to a conference, and I know you went through this not too long back, is it gives you a deadline. Mm-hmm. And deadlines make you write. And one of the other things that happens when you get into teaching is if you don't have that syllabus your teacher handed you telling you your research paper's due November 21st or whatever, it's easy to just take evenings off and catch up on. Well, my daughter's rewatching Grey's Anatomy and it's killing me because it's too much a soap opera for me. But I'm going to make her watch the Justified thing coming up here. When you've got that conference coming up, you've got to have that paper draft written.
So we were just talking about conferences, just really quick. And I want to talk about networking. How has networking affected your academic career? Where and how do you network?
When I first heard that term was actually pretty early on in my academic career. And I'd be curious when it became a regular part of our lexicon. I started hearing about it in graduate school when I would go to conferences, and I really went to conferences just because I was interested in them and interested in hearing the papers and seeing what people were doing. And I think what I would say, as someone who's been on both sides of the situation, someone who others wanted to network with and someone who wanted to network with others, when you're following up on genuine interest and genuine enjoyment of what other people have done, or a real interest in a journal, and it comes across as something that is a true, and again, I'm using the same word repeatedly, but a real genuine involvement in the journal or the scholar or whatever it is you're discussing, then it's absolutely worth your while, because it's the part of you that loves to read and loves to discuss books and loves to discuss literature. You're giving into that, and it's healthy and it's good and it is helpful, because people will put your name with it and they'll be willing to reach out and contact someone for you or let you know, yes, this person is doing a book and they might have a place for a chapter if you want to send it to them. Knowing the writers, knowing editors, makes it easier to just stay in the loop of what's going on. So that you'll hear, I used to always have to go onto the Penn State listserv of calls for papers, and I think they're still keeping that thing up to see what was out there. But now, very often, I'll have people contact me and say, would you be willing to contribute an article for this volume? Would you be willing to talk to us about this? And that's nice, and it's not easy to get to that place, but the more you do, the more it becomes easy. And the other thing is really the best advice anyone can give you, Olivia, is just get as much published as you possibly can. Again, the job market is still strange and mercurial and mysterious. And anyone who's been out of it for more than 10 or 15 years needs to always acknowledge, well, used to it was this way, but I'm not sure what it's like now. And there are ways to help yourself as well that are outside the kind of normal avenues, and that's demonstration of other skills and looking at adjacent positions such as directing writing centers and running a quality enhancement plan if you're in the Southeast, which is a accreditation requirement, that working with grant writing and things like that can often, you know, working for a press, a lot of these kinds of jobs can bring you in the wheelhouse and get you looked at as well for those kind of employment, but not easy.
Publishing is important. So let's talk about that. You are an editorial board member of the Cormac McCarthy Journal, which is a journal that I frequented for years now and is a big part of Cormac McCarthy's scholarship. Tell us a little bit about your role when it comes to the publishing process.
So for the Cormac McCarthy Journal, and I've been a reader for a couple of other journals, and they all pretty much have worked the same way. And by serving on the editorial board, all peer review journals work the same way, that unless you're someone who's really famous and super well known and have had an article solicited for the journal, everyone else goes through blind review. So the editors, once upon a time, and now recently, there are services that kind of do this for you. And you, when you place your article with them, they strip away all indication of who wrote it and where it's coming from. And then it gets sent out to two, maybe three, but usually two readers on the board who will read it and offer comments and mark it up a little bit, these days digitally, as they go through it. And when it's all said and done, they say, accept it as is, it's perfect, or accept it with minor revisions, accept it with major revisions, meaning they come through with all these, accept it, or deny it. It's not ready for the journal or not right for it. And usually most professors are going to fall into the accept it with minor revisions or accept it with major revisions, because we're just incapable of reading anything and saying it's perfect. You know, we all want to mark something up and send it back. It's like you can have the world's greatest dissertation, but someone's going to have something in it that they want you to change. And so that is how it works. And you're given usually a deadline, and you're asked to not take too long. I go out of my way to try to be very helpful and constructive in my comments. And if I think that some of my requests are more a matter of taste than necessary, I'll try to spell that out as well. You know, I'll say that something like, the writer would be warranted in ignoring this, but I think it might be better to bring up this other point as well. And I wouldn't say it more than that. The last few years, I've also been used as a blind reader for a few presses, so university presses, who do the exact same process. They will, in that case, you do know who the writer is, but they'll send out the book and they'll ask you to review it and offer comment on whether they should pick it up. And they'll often give you a long questionnaire of things like, what's the market? Will this be respected in the market? Is this up to date on the scholarship? And you fill all that out. And again, at the end, they'll say, do you think it should be published or not? And I usually will usually try to accept that if I think I can be a positive influence on it. But if it's, well, I've never had the poor situation develop where I disliked someone's work and was asked to read that person, but I would turn it down if that were true. Although it might be the case of that would be someone where I'd go, wow, that's actually great, I've changed my mind. But I don't want to be on the place where I'm turning someone down, you know, out of some kind of bias or preconceived notion of their value in that area. So
what part does publishing play in academia? Let's talk about its importance in the grand scheme of things.
Well, you've just touched upon a very strange subject, because if we're talking about medical academia and curing AIDS or fighting cancer, it's indisputable that it's one of the most important things going on in the world, right? And the world has changed drastically due to academia. If you think of all the amazing things which have been accomplished over the last 100, 150 years in sciences, almost all of that typically is funded somewhere or somewhat by a university somewhere. And the weird thing that happened is, and I don't know when this changed, sometime in the 70s, maybe the 80s, when humanities said we have to get all the same stuff the sciences are getting, and the teaching loads decreased. So when I first got my job, and I'll be honest, I never expected to stay where I went. I thought I was bound for greener pastures. And every time I got ready to apply for something else, something came up. I met the woman who would one day be my wife, or I get ready to apply for something. We find out, you know, the first child is on the way. We get ready to apply, and something happens with the friend or my parents. And then one day I looked up and realized, you're here. Just, you know, go with it and stay with it. When I told my professors my teaching load at that time would be 4 classes, and kind of winced at it, 2 or 3 of them said when they first got hired to University of Alabama in the 60s, they had a 4-class teaching load. So sometime between when I was in graduate school in the 90s and when they were in getting their jobs in the late 60s, in that 30-year period, they didn't teach as much, and maybe they had a greater expectation of publishing. And so I do love publishing. I love reading articles about books. I love the whole, everything about it. But are we going to save a child's life? The answer is no. You know, are we going to stop a bridge from collapsing or a building collapsing because of research we've done? The answer is no. Now, I might argue, no, it will teach someone empathy, and so they decide not to blow up a building in 20 years in the future, and they'll see the world differently. Uh-huh. But it's a little harder to draw that direct line. And so I think one of the readjustments which might happen is that state universities, those professors will be teaching a little more, the grad students teaching a little less, meaning they'll bring in fewer grad students, unfortunately. And the publishing requirements in the humanities and other areas where the workload increases will probably go down a little. The other problem there is, of course, how many state university presses and other university presses have dialed back their publishing. So the old expectation that so many places that you have to get a book out to get published here is no longer a valid or fair expectation for a lot of places, because a lot of them are just not accepting the number of books they used to.
What is the difference of difficulty of publishing now versus 10, 20 years ago?
That's a good question. Well, they're not publishing as many books. I think with the journals, some of the problem is that a lot of different journals either tend to be occupied by the usual suspects, it's the same people publishing in them year in and year out, or they have a very theoretical or political agenda necessarily. And if you haven't researched enough to kind of know exactly what they're looking for, then they're not necessarily going to hear about what you have to say. So, for instance, if you were publishing on a journal that is very much interested in the Southwestern heritage of Native Americans, for example, and then you tell them, well, let's say, paper about Cormac McCarthy, they may initially, if they're not exposed to how much more complex his writing is on that area than people presuppose, their initial reaction might be, well, he's just another white guy. He just died, so now he's literally a dead white guy. Why should we publish him? And it would be part of your job to make sure in the letter you say, here is my interest, here's what I've done, here's why particularly I'm using him. And so the cover letter and the kind of pre-submission contact, and we can call that networking. I think it's a little more legit than just general networking. I think it's really just making sure you know your audience and that the audience is ready to really give you a fair reading in that case as well. But that there's kind of reaching out early and talking to the editor a little bit, which is so that's easy now in a way it never used to be. Everything can be found online, and you can almost get a hold of anyone's email address online in a way it used to not be, you know, possible very often.
I want to sound an invisible syllabus alarm here. Not that you've committed any foul, Scott, but that this is a good teaching moment. I had a professor when I was in my PhD program at University of Memphis who would call our attention specifically to this shift you've invoked a few times from a post office mail-based journal submission and correspondence to web-based journal submission, and which was still very much not completed in 2012 when I began my PhD. Like, it was still journal by journal. Some were still doing mail. And this professor pointed us to that and said, when you do an electronic submission, it may look like you shouldn't write a cover letter. It may look like all you need to do is like tick the boxes of the electronic submission. And he said, they may even in the submission, you know, statement say, don't send an email, no cover letter is necessary. His advice to us was ignore that. Always look for somebody's email address connected to the journal, the editor-in-chief, if no one else, and send, even if it's just two sentences, send an email saying, dear editor, I just submitted my article entitled title to the journal. And I'm really excited about the article where I argue 10 word or less statement of what you argue. Thank you so much for your consideration. I look forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, Chuck Robinson.
And the listeners can't see me nodding ferociously because, yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, the reason they held off so many of them is to stop the onslaught of simple, when you had to put it in an envelope with a self-addressed stamped envelope, return envelope, and pay to have it mailed. It was quite a process, and it took a bit of work to make that happen. The minute it became all digital, at every journal, but particularly, of course, all the creative writing ones, it's just huge onslaught of people submitting, you know, simultaneously to many, many, many publications. And I would say, for creative writing, you should submit simultaneously despite what they say, unless they've solicited it from you, because they're very slow to get back to you, and they very often don't bother. The whole process where people go through slush piles and read it, and your life is every bit as important as theirs. And but for literary journals, it very much is an expectation you're not simultaneously submitting it. You are going to get thoroughly read no matter who it is submitting it, and definitely usually the response time's a little faster than you'll see it you know, especially in a popular creative writing journal. And this is also a place where, to go back to your original question, Olivia, the more things I could put in that cover letter of where I had published and what I had done, the more closely I felt my material had been read, so that even if something gets turned down, there's often a lengthy discussion of why.
Okay.
As opposed to everyone's back in the days of snail mail, everyone had the generic pink or yellow or green Xeroxed rejection slip, and you started getting happy when you had the handwritten notes instead. And then you get to a certain point where you assume it'll probably get accepted if you send it somewhere, but it's only at a certain point in your career when that happens. For me, it was honestly partly just kind of surrendering with the creative writing stuff and focusing on academic writing instead. If I can draw that distinction between them.
Before I move on to my next question, I just wanted to pause really quick. You said something about know your audience, and with Cormac McCarthy, a lot of people tend to think that Cormac McCarthy is just a white guy and there's nothing more to it. But I never run into this problem when it comes to actual readers of Cormac McCarthy. It's everybody else, because my research is multicultural identity and American identity in Cormac McCarthy. And I find a lot of race and multicultural identity there. But I don't know how to make other people see it, but I just have to keep going, I guess, and keep researching, writing about it.
Well, you know, the great thing about him is, first, he's a complicated enough writer that there are so many different things you can focus on, from the most picayune and obvious to the very complex, and where, you know, abundant use of various theories or just straightforward old fashioned scholarship. Here's why he did it this way in this book, because here's what, you know, really existed in the West of 1845 or whatever. And it's also, until very recently, there had not been so much published that most people hadn't read almost everything. And so it means you've got a field of people who are very conversant with not only all of what he wrote, but all of what's been written about him. So they can give you good guidance on oh yeah, great idea. Here's something to check out, and here's something you want to read. Maybe look at this as well. And I think there's still a lot of room for that to grow. And it's kind of exciting because I do believe our field changed and evolved drastically between the end of World War II through, let's say, the end of the, of, you know, through 2000. And it's been going through another iteration of that here recently. And am I right in hearing that you're in you're in an online creative, or excuse me, an online master's program currently?
Currently. I graduated. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Graduated, right. And I knew that. Now you're looking for PhD programs. Just the, you know, that didn't exist 15 years ago. And when they did, they were usually just kind of weak correspondence courses. So they've evolved and changed so drastically, and they're so much better than they used to be. So it is a brave new world. And of course, there's a lot of bad things that have come out of the changes, but there's a lot of good things that have come out of the changes. So you were talking about access earlier, and think about how much greater access is where you can be in a class with someone who's across the continent and have great, valuable, you know, discussion interchange. And once upon a time, if you weren't in the right city and couldn't afford to move there and quit work, it wasn't available for you. So that's a nice change. But to go back to the publishing in general and ways of making people interested in what you're doing, I think McCarthy Field is good because there's no gatekeepers. There's no one saying, yeah, you're not one of the people we recognize. You haven't been in the right program with the right mentor. And I don't think that's as bad as it used to be, but there were certain writers in certain fields where it was pretty bad. And I think there probably a few of them are still out there. So when I was a graduate student in Alabama, my professor was the teacher of the American Literature Survey, second half American Lit Survey correspondence course, that they were still doing correspondence courses back then. And she would always travel to England. And so two summers in a row, I took over her class for her. And in a way, it was great. I got paid for teaching a whole class, but all I was doing was grading people's handwritten responses and sometimes typed responses to these series of questions that would go out in the mail, you know, read this, you know, pay attention to all these notes, all pre-written. And so when we first started doing our asynchronous online classes, all our classes were constructed more or less the same way. And I finally realized is what I enjoy about teaching, which is basically what we're doing right now, the back and forth and exchange, may never be in the classroom, but I can at least do a lot more of my delivery to make it where even if my experience is always going to be much less satisfying than face-to-face teaching, the student's experience won't be quite so bad. So I've kind of gone on I redid the class 3 or 4 years ago, and I've been on a mission to have a video lecture discussion for every single thing I teach. And I'm still a little short. A few of them are just still annotated public domain PDFs where I'll highlight something and write a note out to the side. But we've done it a cheap way. I've just done it on YouTube, and I'll just put the link in the class notes. And the class understanding materials is far greater. It's no more fun for me than it was until I get the occasional student like Olivia who will actually reach out to me. And of course, I'll constantly say, I'm available to chat about any of this if you want to. And I've created Google Hangouts and things like that for that purpose. And I've had a few kind of make use of it, but mostly not. I think that though is the answer to, you know, even if you can't change the syllabus or you're mostly evaluating and grading, allowing, you know, empowering the professor to reach out and help the student, I think is the way to move that forward in the future.
All right. I only have one more question for you. What writing and publishing goals should graduate students have? And how do these goals develop from first year MA to final year PhD?
Well, I would say as early MA students, it's trying to, well, I'll actually give you a bit of advice for going to the PhD program in terms of writing in general that I think can be very helpful. For your master's program and just having completed it, getting to a conference or two, and just hearing what a lot of people are doing at the conference is very valuable for you because on the one hand, it just introduces you to the field. you know, this is the occupation you want to be part of. And this is actually one of the joys. It's one of the few times you can actually talk to people who have just as much love for the material as you do mm-hmm. and as much interest in it as you do. And you realize that some of these people are not ogres. They're human and they're pretty easy to relate to, and they can be helpful. The other thing is it you don't necessarily put them on a pedestal. You think, well, that guy's sharp and I've read, you know, his book and I read her book, but that thing they just said was kind of dumb and here's where it's wrong. And you kind of realize they're not at some lofty level you can't attain. They may have read a little more of it or been at it a little longer, but it becomes something you realize in your bones. Yes, I can do that for sure. Cause I do think a lack of confidence can hurt new graduate students as well. And the advice I would give you going into a PhD program is if you can figure out really early on what your subject is going to be and ensure that almost every paper you write in every class will contribute towards your final dissertation, then that can be really, really beneficial to you. I decided to do that, and I had friends who 3 years in had not chosen their major defense subject for orals, had not chosen what to do their dissertation on, and of course they were on a 6 or 7 year plan, and schools have really lost their patience with that these days. And if you know, let's just say, for example, you decide to do Cormac McCarthy. If you know that going in and you make sure that if you take an American popular culture class, Cormac McCarthy and the Western, right? If you take a Southern Lit class, you know, Cormac McCarthy is who I'm writing on. And if you were to do that, and it doesn't necessarily mean the project or paper you write to fulfill a class obligation ends up in your dissertation, but all the work you do reading sources and building your own personal bibliography can be really helpful to you. And I will tell you, the advice you get changes every few years. When I went in, I was told it's always so much better to have a really strong single author. And now everyone says, whatever you do, avoid single author and choose a subject. And then you have to be careful, so when I'm trying to hire at a small school, if someone has chosen a very esoteric field that's very theory laden, the first question I have reading their CV and their letter is, okay, nice. Yeah, it's really cool. But can they actually teach freshman English? Can they still teach a survey of American literature? You know, have they had experiences with just the Norton Anthology? And mm-hmm. or has everything been so, because the lower down the food chain you are, the more traditional the programs tend to be, because the more those programs are fighting for their lives and they're trying to demonstrate their value. And the more you kind of challenge the old system, then the less easy it is to get trustee members and presidents and chief financial officers to value those things so much.
I think this is a good place for me to modulate your advice about making all of your graduate coursework sort of part of your dissertation workflow. The old hardcore version, which was still being advertised to me when I started what would become my master's degree at Syracuse in 2006, was one graduate seminar, one dissertation chapter. That advice is bad because, as Scott said, it's not really about having a draft of a dissertation chapter when you leave that particular graduate seminar. It's more just about amassing work that would then be applicable to your future dissertation. What I would add to that is about everything that Scott just said about this moving target of what is the theory that's in, or what kind of reading are we, quote unquote, we doing these days. And that you would use each graduate seminar, you have a pretty clear idea of what you're interested in. So if it's identity, both American and multicultural in Cormac McCarthy, that mm-hmm. you would use each seminar to explore a means of exploring that question, right? So you might not even write about McCarthy, but you might say, here is paradigm one for discussing ethnic identity. Here's paradigm one for discussing multi-ethnic America. Because that's what I did when I was working through my PhD, and I found it much more productive. I had a very close friend who was working on children's literature, and so every course she was in, no matter what the topic of the course, she would just add "and children's literature," and that would and that would somehow be the topic of her paper. An anecdote doesn't really, you know, change anything much, but I would say between the two of us, I had a much easier time writing my dissertation because I had a more fluid understanding of the discussions, whereas she had, you know, seven artifacts, seven papers that she had written that she didn't right. want to let go of.
The other thing that I didn't really believe was true, but it was true for me, is I received a warning if you publish too many chapters or pieces of your dissertation. Not some publishers disapprove of that, and they want to take the book. And okay. I didn't believe that at all, so I chopped up little pieces and sent them out, and had some pretty good luck getting things published. And sure enough, when I finally sent off the dissertation to someone, they wrote back, "We just think you put too much of this out there already." And I really had not believed that to be a real problem. I'd heard about it from people, but I didn't put any faith in it. And it, it actually happened to me. Part of it is I probably, you know, part of it was that part of my letter was bragging about, here's all the stuff I've published. And anyone, if they're reading that letter carefully and then looking at the book, they're seeing, well, it's this thing. That's just part two of chapter three. And that's just part one of chapter four, and so on. So I would say if you, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to let it go. And of course, older faculty are sometimes able to bring out a collection of essays, especially if they're coherent enough that even if it's not written really as a single book, but it is something to think about a little bit and at least be able to make sure you've got enough new stuff or different things in there as well. For some people, it's better just to leave the dissertation be and move on to the next thing and then come back to the dissertation if, you know, if it's not too out of date.
This is more of a comment than a question. the answer may end up just being a one-word answer from you, Scott, but I want to go back to what you said about anyone who's 10 or 15 years out of the job market should be real careful about what they say and how they understand the job market. That's not a great paraphrase, but you did stick in that caveat. I want to stick in my thoughts as someone who's been at the bottom of the job market more recently than you. I think your understanding as someone who's in administration now is probably much better at a global level at understanding what's happening regionally, what's happening in the different echelons of academia. Right. But as someone who is in the trenches of trying to find a job in 2017, 18, 19, et cetera, I can say that in my anecdotal experience, the general teaching load now at elite schools and big state schools is now 3-3 across the board, and much more frequently 4-4.
That has really changed then, yeah.
In the small liberal arts colleges and community colleges was actually 5-5.
Yeah, community colleges is very typically 5-5. They also don't have expectations of scholarship beyond maybe occasional pedagogical workshops and things like that. But
well, now here's where I've seen interesting things, and I have to say correlation and causation, warning, blah, 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 right? We can't necessarily right. connect these two things. And there's a lot of sleuthing that one has to do to see, like, well, I didn't get a job. Who did get that job, right? Mm. Anyway, what I noticed in a few cases that I got really invested in because I poured so much more energy into those applications, they were jobs where I thought my relatively low publishing profile wouldn't be a problem. And then afterwards, it sure looks to me like the person who got the job had more research.
Right.
Had more publications. And these were in jobs at community colleges. at small liberal arts colleges. So it's kind of like the angry, exaggerated thing I would often say is like, there are too many brain surgeons, and so now they are hiring brain surgeons who are good at golf. Yeah. And only good at golf.
Well, and I think what you're saying is true, because there are too many of those programs put out too many PhDs for a while. And the problem with that is just when it comes to the job market, because they've depended for so long on those PhD candidates and really master's candidates to teach freshmen, sophomore, sometimes upper level English, because the famous one class a year professor didn't want to have to teach it. And I knew that what everyone knew really would be fair to people is you have to up the number of classes being taught by the professors. And part of that, so the undergraduates at those schools are actually really getting taught by people who are, you know, it's why they want to go to that school and be in that major. And part of it is so that they wouldn't keep pulling people into those programs who just could not get a job because so few of them are out there. But I also, at different times, have seen where someone I knew applied for a job who was perfect for it, and you see the person who got the job, and you say they don't have near the publications this other person did, and they don't have near the, you know, the college they went to is more or less the same. And so what's the difference? And it's often oblique, and you never know if you know, one search committee member likes this person and one likes that person and what's going on in the background. And it often just seems so mysterious. I will tell you that for smaller universities, and I think this is probably true at community colleges, the teaching demonstration is a much bigger deal than the scholarship demonstration. And if you can get students excited and eating out of your hand during your teaching demonstration, that'll go a long way. With your, where are you living, Olivia? You're in the West, right? You're in?
Yeah, I just moved from Maryland to California, actually.
Right. So the great thing about California is there are so many colleges of all sorts and so many community colleges, and they all need part-timers. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who, although he's a high school teacher in California for years, he's taught four or five classes in community colleges as well, and has made just, from my East Coast South perspective, a boatload of money doing it. And so that's a great way to, there are a lot of, and I don't say this disparagingly, there are a lot of community colleges that will just hire you if you've got the credentials. And you can say, I don't have any experience, I don't know. They'll say, well, here's your syllabus, here's the book. That'll get you through. And I taught, so when I was between when I finished my master's and went back working for the state of Florida, I also taught at the community college there in Tallahassee. And then when I went for my PhD, I looked at my paycheck and I looked at my bills and said, that's not going to work. And I ended up also picking up two classes on the side at the local community college and working in a writing center. So, and I have to say that probably made me better able to get a job at a small college than my scholarship did, which was not significant. I won a couple of big short story prizes, but I wasn't doing creative writing anymore, right? And I had probably published three or four book reviews and I think a book chapter and two refereed articles. So that was the sum total of my CV coming out of PhD programs. And there are so many PhD candidates now who have much stronger and less scattered resumes than that. And but it does, that teaching does help you. So don't, you know, as much as you can do of any sort, that's going to look good on your CV as well. Classes taught of this sort and that sort.
Thank you for listening. If you have a question or topic you'd like covered on an Academic Odyssey, email us at thephdpod@gmail.com. You can also find us at Academic Odd Pod on Twitter, or what is now known as X. The views presented here are those of the host and our guest and do not necessarily represent the views of our respective institutions.